Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Lucia Milanig, John Russell, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Lucia Milanig.
Accusations of Sexual Wrongdoing by film producer Harvey Weinstein and other famous people are having an effect on American businesses. What is being called the Weinstein effect has men in powerful positions facing similar accusations. It is also increasing understanding about the difference between friendly exchanges and criminal acts. American Tyler Phillips has worked in the service industry since he was 15 years old. He now makes coffee and other drinks for a living. Phillips has witnessed the power imbalance in places where he worked. He says he has seen wealthy customers making unkind comments or taking unwanted actions toward younger, low-wage workers. Sexism, racism is endemic to this industry, he says. But Phillips also admits that he, like many others in the service industry, has no guidance from his employers on how to intervene in these situations. So he joined several other people after work for a class on sexual harassment at the Potter's House. The 57-year-old store has made a name for itself in the Washington, D.C. area. Locals like to go to the Potter's House because, unlike many coffee shops, it offers safe spaces for discussion and creative expression. Its business model is almost unheard of in the industry. It is a nonprofit business, asking customers to pay what you can for a cup of coffee. Melissa Yeo and other volunteers set up the training from a group called Collective Action for Safe Spaces. It started 8 years ago with a goal of ending sexual harassment and abuse in the D.C. area. The demand for the classes increased last month after Harvey Weinstein and other influential men were accused of sexual harassment. Yeo notes that many people are unwilling to step in and stop harassment. For them, she says, it is often not knowing if it will work, not knowing exactly what to do, or thinking it's none of their business. On a recent day, the coffee workers attending the class were from all over the D.C. area. They shared personal stories, which proved how common the problem is. Some explained what they did to stop the abuse. They started by saying their first name and what gender they identify with. "My name is Sam," said one man, as he began telling what he witnessed. He says a customer made a coworker so uneasy with comments about her body that she left the area. Sam spoke to the man and asked that he stop from making comments on the appearance of people who work in this space. Instead of stopping, the customer argued that he was raised in the 1950s. "That's no excuse," said the leader of the class. The exercise continued until all the workers shared their experiences. The group decided how severe the discrimination was and rated it with markings on the wall in the front of the room. Then Yo added 4 more actions, including misgendering and following. Each of the 4 was written on a piece of paper and added to the wall. The 2-hour class ended with students role-playing. Each person took on the behavior of someone else as part of a training exercise. Mike Balderrama, one of the students, is the acting general manager of the Potter's House. He says the subject of intervening and stopping discrimination is very near and dear to our heart. Balderrama said the next training program for coffee shop employees is expected to deal with mental health and first aid. So the Potter's House will once again create the place for exploration of those issues. I'm Lucia Malanig.
Cities, particularly in Europe, are increasingly taking steps against tourists. Venice, Italy, for example, is planning to bar some large passenger ships. Barcelona, Spain, has placed restrictions on apartment rentals. The problem these cities say they are dealing with is over-tourism. Too many tourists visiting at once. Jonathan Keats is the chairman of the Venice in Peril Fund, an aid and activist group. He said too many people are crowding the walkways and canals of Venice, interfering in what he calls a still living city. Talib Rifai is the Secretary General of the United Nations World Tourism Organization, or UNWTO. He spoke recently to tourism ministers at London's World Travel Market. He said the rise of slogans such as "Tourists go home" and "Tourists are terrorists" was a wake-up call. Anger about tourism could continue to grow as more people travel every year. The UNWTO estimates tourists will take 1.8 billion trips by 2030, up from 1.2 billion in 2016. Low-cost airline tickets are helping fuel the growth in tourism numbers, along with increasing travel from China. Yet many places depend on tourism for jobs and wealth. Around 10% of the world's gross domestic product, or GDP, comes from tourism. Talib Rifai said that growth is not the enemy. But he said tourism must be made sustainable and responsible to help local communities. Ecuador permits only 100,000 visitors to the Galapagos Islands each year. The Croatian city of Dubrovnik is considering permitting only 4,000 visitors daily. Visitors have flooded the Adriatic Sea town since it was used as a setting for the television series Game of Thrones. I'm John Russell.
American electric car maker Tesla hopes its electric-powered trucks will replace today's diesel-fueled ones. Tesla founder Elon Musk showed off the new truck, called the Tesla Semi, during a launch event in Los Angeles. The company also announced a new sports car model. Musk said the truck can travel 800 kilometers on a single electric charge while pulling a full load of 36,000 kilograms. Musk did not give an exact price for the new trucks. Instead, he said the cost of operating the Tesla truck will be less than diesel trucks because of fuel savings and lower maintenance costs. He even claimed that moving goods with the Tesla Semi would cost less than transporting them by train. Musk said production will begin in 2019. The company says interested buyers could pay $5,000 to reserve a truck. Musk told a crowd gathered to see the launch he believes the new truck's features are better in every way than any current transport trucks on the road. The trucks will be equipped with the same driver assist system built into some of Tesla's other vehicles. The autopilot system can keep vehicles at a set speed and is capable of slowing them down automatically. It can also keep vehicles within traffic lanes. Musk said he can imagine that someday several Tesla electric trucks will autonomously follow each other down the road. He added that the company plans to build a worldwide system of solar-powered megachargers to provide electrical charges for the trucks. He said the system could power trucks for another 640 kilometers after charging for as little as 30 minutes. Tesla and other major manufacturers are making big investments in electric vehicles in a worldwide shift to energy-saving technologies. U.S. government information shows that trucks create nearly one-fourth of all transportation-related greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gases are blamed for trapping heat and warming the Earth's atmosphere. Tesla faces competition in the electric truck market, however. German carmakers Volkswagen and Daimler AG are designing their own versions. Daimler recently showed off its first all-electric zero-emission transport truck in Germany. In the U.S., Nikola Motor Company is developing electric transport trucks powered by hydrogen. It says the trucks will be able to travel up to 1,900 kilometers with a refill time of just 15 minutes. At the publicity event, Musk surprised the crowd with a new model of Tesla's Roadster. The car unexpectedly drove out of the back of the Tesla Semi. Musk said he was pleased to announce that Tesla was launching the second-generation Roadster, a new version of the first car the company made. Tesla said its updated Roadster will break several world records. Musk said the sports car will be the first vehicle in regular production to reach 100 kilometers an hour in just 1.9 seconds. Musk added that the car will have a travel range of 1,000 kilometers on a single charge, which he said would be a new record for an electric vehicle. I'm Brian Lynn.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The year was 1775. Colonists in Massachusetts had fought battles with British troops in the towns of Lexington and Concord. War had not been declared, but citizen soldiers in each of the 13 American colonies were ready to fight. Who was going to organize the colonists into an army? This was the first question that faced the Second Continental Congress when delegates met in May in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The delegates decided that the man for the job was George Washington. He had experience fighting in the French and Indian War. He seemed to know more than any other colonist about being a military commander. The delegates elected him as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He accepted the position, but said he would not take any money for leading the new army. George Washington left Philadelphia for Massachusetts, where he took command on July 3, 1775.
He was tall, he was very elegant, very well put together.
Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society says Washington looked very impressive.
It's very interesting because when he came to take command of the Continental Army, many of the New England soldiers were not quite sure what to make of this man who was, after all, from Virginia, not from New England. Washington won them over. His conduct, his grace, I think his discipline was extremely important.
Back in Philadelphia, the delegates to the Second Continental Congress made one more attempt to prevent war with Great Britain. They sent another message to King George. They asked him to consider their problems and try to find a solution. The king would not even read the message. You might wonder, why would the delegates try to prevent war if the people were ready to fight? The answer is that most of the members of the Congress and most of the colonists were not yet ready to break away from England. They continued to believe they could have greater self-government and still be part of the British Empire. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society says many colonists felt conflicted and confused about their identity.
They're Englishmen, they're still Englishmen, but they're not Englishmen. All along, what they've wanted is just to have the rights of Englishmen, and it doesn't seem to be possible under an old system.
A major battle took place in June of 1775, just 2 days after the delegates in Philadelphia chose George Washington as commander. It was the first major battle of the American Revolution. It was called the Battle of Bunker Hill, although it really involved two hills, Bunker and Breeds. Both are just across the Charles River from the city of Boston. Massachusetts soldiers dug positions on Breed's Hill. The British started to attack from across the river. The Americans had very little gunpowder. They were forced to wait until the British had crossed the river and were almost on top of them before they fired their guns. Their commander reportedly told them not to fire on the British until they saw the whites of their eyes. The British climbed the hill. The Americans fired. A second group of British soldiers climbed the hill. The Americans fired again. The third time, the British reached the top, but the Americans were gone. They had left because they had no more gunpowder. Peter Drummy, a librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society, reads part of a letter that a young soldier wrote to his mother.
I was in the fort when the enemy came in, jumped over the wall, and ran half a mile, where balls, that is, musket balls, flew like hailstones and cannon roared like thunder.
The British captured Breed's Hill, but Peter Drummy says the Americans still considered the battle a kind of victory.
The paradox is, even though the American forces are defeated and forced off the hill, nevertheless, the British casualties are so high that it is at least a moral victory.
Even the young American soldier who fled the battle wrote to his mother that he would continue fighting for American independence.
And in fact, that's probably what the British learned from this battle, that they could capture this hill at great cost, but the New England countryside is full of hills, and they couldn't capture them all back.
That battle also reduced whatever hope was left for a negotiated settlement. King George declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. The American colonists fought several battles against British troops in 1775. Yet, the colonists were still not ready to declare war. Then, the following year, the British decided to use Hessian soldiers to fight against the colonists. Hessians were mostly German mercenaries who fought for anyone who paid them. The colonists feared these soldiers and hated the British for using them. In January of 1776, Thomas Paine published a document that strongly influenced the colonists. He named the pamphlet Common Sense. It attacked King George as well as the idea of a monarchy, a government led by a king or queen. The pamphlet called for independence. About 150,000 copies of Common Sense were sold in the colonies. Everyone talked about it. As a result, the Second Continental Congress began to act. It opened American ports to foreign shipping. It urged colonists to establish state governments and to write constitutions. On June 7th, 1776, Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee proposed a resolution for independence. The resolution was not approved immediately. Declaring independence was an extremely serious step. Signing such a document would make the delegates traitors to Britain. They would be killed if captured by the British. The delegates wanted the world to understand what they were doing and why. So they appointed a committee to write a document giving the reasons for their actions. One member of this committee was Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. He had already written a report criticizing the monarchy. So the other committee members asked him to write the new document. They said he was the best writer in the group. They were right. Jefferson was 33 years old. It took him 17 days to write the document. The Second Continental Congress approved it on July 4, 1776. It was America's Declaration of Independence. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University says the Declaration was a message to the world.
They are trying to, I think, signal to the world, we are a new nation, we've broken away from this other nation. We're a separate nation, and we want recognition of our independence.
The Declaration of Independence begins with these words.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
The Declaration goes on to say,
we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
The British believed that the Americans were violating British law. Jefferson argued that the British treatment of the American colonies violated the natural laws of God. This idea of natural law had been expressed by British and French philosophers more than 100 years earlier. Jefferson had studied these philosophers in school, but in writing the Declaration of Independence, he said the words came straight from his heart. The Declaration goes on to list 27 complaints against the king. There are complaints against taxes without the consent of the colonists and against the presence of British troops in the colonies. After the list, Jefferson went on to write this statement.
That these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have the full power to levy war, conduct peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Jefferson concluded the Declaration with a line that was meant to persuade the delegates to support the most serious step, revolution.
And for the support of this Declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Delegates to the Continental Congress approved and signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. The new country, called the United States of America, was at war with Britain. Yet, not everyone in the former colonies agreed with the decision. That will be our story tomorrow. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.